kind of stuck for the moment with a two-party system. Let's see what the Dems in D.C. get out of the current budget impasse, when the biggest threat to Homeland Security is Homeland Security, when the head of the War Department is aching to live up to that name, the Attorney General is the Attack Dog General, Department of Injustice, Department of Draining the Treasury. The federal government is too far gone at the moment. Many more of the states need to speak up for their people and the country as a whole. States got the power. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, February 4th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Dave Johnson, Anna Francis, and Rain Crow. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Edward J. Vieira, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Bill Newman, Mike Moen, and Farah Siddiqui. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. KBOO reporter Rain Crow is on the ground in Minneapolis. In her latest dispatch, she attends a caucus for the Democratic Farmer Labor Party and talked to birth workers and organizers around town.
This is Rain Crow. I am here at South High School on the night of the Minneapolis caucuses. What brings you out? Have you done this before? What are you hoping to experience tonight?
I'm going to offer to be a delegate or a delegate alternate so that I can do whatever is within my power to help my community stand up against Metro Surge and protect us against what I consider to be a violation of our constitutional rights.
Yeah, this is my first time going to a caucus. I am 24, so I'm a little bit younger, and I think it's important just to be more educated on the candidates that we're going to be voting for, and I think primaries and caucuses are really important to make sure that the candidates that are representing us actually represent our thoughts and our feelings about this.
I would like to see what we can actually do to combat this. This isn't right, and so we're tired of hearing we're on your side, you're safe in all this, and obviously we're not safe, and it doesn't feel like they're on our side, they're not on the people's side. So we're looking for action, we're looking for change, and not just saying it's going to be okay with empty promises.
I'm here at South High School for the night of caucuses with
Hassan Mahmoud.
Thank you. And given everything that's been happening with Operation Metro Surge, do you feel safe to be here tonight?
I just trust God and the community of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
They stand with us, with those targeted illegally, actually. It's in our constitution. I'm a U.S. citizen, so in our constitution, it's illegal to target certain people because of their origin, nationality, or color, or ethnicity, or religion, and all those affiliation of sex, all those.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Sorry, our president,
yeah,
doesn't pay attention for those.
And what brings you out tonight? What are you hoping to have happen?
I'm just endorse some of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm enjoying it, endorsing it, some of the candidates.
Is there anything in particular you want the candidates to take into account or to fight for?
Just everybody, every citizen is right. Every human being is right.
Mm-hmm. When,
nobody dropped from the sky. We are all brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And we are not in the border.
That's right.
I know Canada border is close here, but no illegal undocumented people come from Canada.
Right.
The closest border is Mexico, and if there came from here and there and here, they are one of us.
Mm-hmm.
We should treat them for one of us.
Okay.
Those Somali targeted, the thousands of miles away, they flew. Some of them came from Latin America, and they have been arrested, interviewed, gave the temporary legal protection, and they gave a work permit. They were working, but now they are prisoners in home.
Mm-hmm.
So that to just fight for those rights and to the unity of the all American.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. I don't want you to be late for your precinct.
No problem. Thank you very much.
This is Rain Crow at the Mayday Cafe in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm with
Will Blake, Robert Bostic.
Today I am here to ask you about the recent DHS mandate that immigration agents in the city wear body cameras, and I'm curious what you think about that.
I think it's not to be trusted. I think it's another smoke and mirrors thing. I think they're doing this so they can say, yeah, we're being transparent, but actually I think they're going to doctor the footage. And they're going to lie like they always do about everything. You know, these people lied about two murders that happened. They lied instantaneously. That was their first reaction. I mean, and it was from Trump on down. I mean, the highest of the high. And government lied immediately after. Immediately. No hesitation. So we're going to trust them with cameras? Body cameras? I don't think so. We're not that stupid.
I think they are a distraction to what I see as the big issue is that ICE is a racist paramilitary force that's terrorizing our neighborhoods. And ICE needs to be dismantled and put out of our misery. And the DHS needs to be broken up into the organizations that it used to be, because it's clearly out of control and they're murdering Americans in the street, and it is unacceptable.
Right. Thank you so much. And so it sounds like to some extent this could be framed as, you use the word distraction, but also a step in the direction of reform rather than abolition.
There is no reforming ICE. There is no reforming it. No, it's full of goons and racists,
exactly,
and white nationalists.
That's a posture. That's just a posture. Yeah, they're not reforming anything.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Miller is an avowed racist. He is behind all of the whole architecture of this. And, you know, you don't reform
He's
him.
Also, also likely a psychopath.
Oh, for sure.
Okay. So you are not under the impression or opinion that this wearing body cameras will change the amount of intimidation or actual violence?
Not at all. Will not change
not
a thing.
All.
Oops, I forgot to turn my camera on. Oh, how convenient.
Yeah. Well, just like the sudden investigation by the FBI of Alex murder, you know,
ICE Reddy.
Reddy's murder. I'm sure the result is going to be that they're totally innocent of all charges. You know, that's why they're doing it. How dare you say that we investigated? What, you like terrorists? You must like terrorists if you don't agree with us. And that's their MO. They're not changing anything. That's Trump's whole MO. Distraction, lying and distraction and more distraction. I'm backing off. No, and then he goes and does something horrible and something else horrible. Oh, I'm backing up. No. And it's fascism is what it is.
Fascism.
It's classic.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
A
agreed.
Is there anything you believe that the mainstream media is not getting right or is missing about what's happening here?
They're missing a lot of it. You know, there is a lot of both ciderism-ing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, where's the questioning of the competency of this administration? I mean, the serious questioning of it. We're not getting any of that in the mainstream press.
Mm-hmm. You know,
we have to look to independent media to get any kind of decent information. I mean, you know, most of those major outlets are owned by billionaires who are invested in this fascist regime.
Totally. Yep.
And when you say both side ism, you're meaning that there's an attempt at neutrality, which downplays the actual violence that's happening
exactly.
here.
Exactly. There are not two equal sides with equal weighted opinions. One is terrorism, government terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism, and the other is citizens of the United States and their victims.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two sides. There are no other sides.
In some ways, this reminds me of the U.S. Funded and trained death squads in Central America in the 80s.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of parallels there. Kidnapping people, murdering people in the streets.
Yep. Disappearing young people.
Disappearing people.
In the middle of the night, never seen again. Mothers marching. Where are my sons? In the 70s, where are my sons?
Right.
In the 80s?
Yep.
Right, and how have you each in your own ways, I'm sure, been participating in this collective resistance?
Well, we're watching the streets. You know, we have the signal groups in the neighborhoods. Some of them are quite hyper-local. And if there's something going on, we all find out about it, and whoever is able to get out in the street and react, that's what we do.
Yesterday I was standing with some elementary school watchers. It covered the school.
Yes, excuse me. Why do we have to protect elementary schools? Why do we have to be out there making sure that children are safely getting to their schools and getting home again?
No, it's a great point. How can you be neutral when that kind of thing is happening? And it's happening a lot. There's a five-year-old that was sent to a concentration camp in Texas, in the United States, by the United States government. How is that a okay thing in any scope of the imagination?
Yeah, privately owned detention centers. I mean, the corruption is obvious.
I'm at the Reverie Cafe and Bar, which is a local hangout right by Powderhorn Park, and I'm with
Sylvia Sparks O'Neill.
And you were about to tell me about your work in a community clinic, and please feel free to share anything about that.
Yeah, so I work in a small community clinic. We have about 75 to 100 employees at any given time, and we do medical, behavioral health, dental, and we serve a community in the heart of Minneapolis, in the heart of South Minneapolis. We kind of take an integrated care model, so I'm the in-house community doula.
And you were sharing before we started recording that a large part of the patients, the clientele who come in are Somali?
Yeah, so most of our patients are Somali and Ethiopian, so we have patients that speak Somali, Oromo, and Amharic, and we work with bulk of our patients, I would say 70 to 80%.
And how has this Operation Metro Surge affected your work?
I mean, the clinic itself has been struggling with funding issues and, you know, fear of losing funding since the Trump administration took effect, and that's really affected our operations, even going back to I started actually January 21st. It was the day after Inauguration Day of 2025, and so I've been at the clinic for about a year. As far as funding, that has affected our clinic and our ability to provide patient care all year throughout 2025. And then when Operation Metro Surge happened, as well as like all the different direct targets on the Somali community, it's been affecting people's ability to access resources, like especially when it comes to food, because there's been so much press around this alleged fraud in the Somali community. And so, like, for example, I've been trying to work with a program to get food delivered to families, meals, because I'm a doula. It's specifically focusing on pregnancy and postpartum, and so getting high quality nutritional options to families. And this program is like, it's great on the surface because it's delivered to their door. It allows them to, you know, not have to think so much. And there's a lot of mouths to feed. You know, a lot of Somali families are larger. Like, the average family size is 5 to 7, I would say. And so the food program, as I'm trying to get that started, I'm having trouble getting people signed up because they don't want to be involved with anything even related to that. They're afraid of getting in trouble. They're afraid of being targeted again. They're afraid of government help in any way. I mean, we do receive some of our funding federally. Of course, our clinic is its own entity. And those feelings, those fears are valid. I mean, that institutional distrust affects people's ability to access services. I take those concerns that people have really seriously and their privacy very seriously. But then we have trouble because some of our leadership doesn't take it seriously or doesn't have that direct patient care or relationship with the community, which is difficult as a work environment.
Are you seeing less of your regular patients come in for fear of what's happening?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So people aren't getting, aren't showing up even for prenatal visits, which like tend to have the highest rates of people wanting to show up, because a lot of times people will show up for their baby but not for themselves. But even with prenatal appointments, we've had a really low attendance at the clinic. I run a mom's program that's culturally targeted for that community, along with a couple of my colleagues. And the mom's group it's been like hard to even get 1 to 2 people there. People will sign up, but then something else will happen and they will be like inside because of fear, or because, you know, there was a recent strike on January 30th, and because the children couldn't go to school that day, that affected the mom's ability to come in and get her prenatal appointment and also get the other services we're offering there, which include food, a hot breakfast, we have yoga, a yoga class that goes alongside the prenatal. So it's sort of this like integrated maternal care to try and support mind, body, spirit of the women.
That was KABU reporter Rain Crow reporting from Minneapolis. You're listening to KABU News In Depth. Thanks for being with us.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Street Roots is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon that creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change. So the article that we're discussing today is called Lost in Translation: The State Professionalized Helping Patients Understand Their Doctors, but the Interpreters Union Says They're Last to Be Paid. This article is by Jake Thomas. Hi, Jake. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Jake, this story starts out with the story of JP, a medical interpreter, and his struggles doing this work and not being compensated enough. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that work looks like and how people are impacted by this kind of work?
Right. So it starts out with Juan Pablo Loyola, who goes by JP. He's a Chilean immigrant. He came to the United States a while ago on a visa that allowed him to work as a physical therapist in hospitals. And he told me that he worked in hospitals in Indiana, Ohio, and Florida. And during that time, he was sort of the unofficial translator. just because being from Chile, he spoke, you know, he spoke native Spanish, fluent Spanish. And so he would get pulled in to help out with appointments for other patients where there was a language issue. Like a lot of medical professionals, he described getting really burnt out during the pandemic, just having to work so hard all the time. And so he did a move across the country in 2024 to Oregon. And he ended up doing medical interpreting, professionally. And he described one story in there where there was just a family that had come into the hospital multiple times, and the family had a developmentally disabled child who was young, and there was something wrong. He was in pain, and there was something going on with him, and the doctors just couldn't figure out what was going on. There was some sort of layer of misunderstanding, as he put it, and he was able to figure out that the child had a what's called a G tube, a gastrostomy tube, that's where the child gets nutrients, and it was the wrong size and it was hurting the child. And so he had to work through all this medical terminology and, you know, cultural nuance and the language, and, you know, go back and forth. And, you know, without him, they wouldn't have figured out what was going on. He's been working as a medical interpreter, and but it's pretty rare, my understanding from my reporting, for somebody to have like a staff position as an interpreter. That these jobs are just always end up being freelance contractor jobs, which anyone who's done that kind of work knows that there's, you know, upsides and downsides to it, but it is just the rate they're getting, that some of them told me that they're getting paid, was kind of surprising, just considering the complexity and importance of their work.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like really essential work. That is, you know, the thing determining whether people actually get the care they need or not. And yeah, you were talking a little bit about the shortcomings of this kind of work, and specifically the contractor position, which, you know, I think a lot of people know that if you do your taxes as a contractor, you often have to pay a lot of money, and you often make less.
Yeah.
What are some of the other kind of difficulties with the financing behind these jobs?
So the way it was described to me in my reporting is, so my story really focused on Medicaid, where there's a real need for interpreters. And in Oregon, the version of Medicaid we have here is the Oregon Health Plan. You know, it's a state federal program, but Oregon, that's just the state's version. And so the way the money flows through it is, there is, you know, it comes from the federal government. It goes to the Oregon Health Authority. Then the Oregon Health Authority will hires what's called coordinated care organizations, which are function basically essentially as insurers, like they're insurance companies, but they do Medicaid. And so they coordinate the care for their members, for people who enroll with them in their Medicaid programs. So they're they have this big they get this big check from the state essentially every year. And that's their budget. And so then from there, the coordinated care organizations, they'll hire these third-party companies, which are called like language access or interpretation companies. And there's a bunch of them, and they do pretty much what you'd think they do. It's like, if you need an interpreter for whatever, you call them up and they'll send an interpreter out. And the problem, and it would make sense you'd have it this sort of arrangement, because, you know, you don't know when you're going to need an interpreter, especially for like medical, you know, a medical interpreter in particular, because you don't know when you're going to have to go get medical care. So you want to have people who are available around the clock. You want to have like just a big pool of people that can speak of, you know, the big languages, of course, like Spanish, Russian, Vietnamese, but also maybe somebody speaks Farsi or Tibetan or just some language, and you need to have somebody. So you want to have this big pool of people that can speak the language. And so that's why it's hard for it to be like a 9-to-5 staff job. The problem with all this that I hear from the interpreters and their union is that by the time the money goes from the federal government to the health authority to the coordinated care organizations and to the to the language access companies, and by the time it gets to the interpreter, they're getting paid like as low as $20. Like $20 to $30, on the upper end, like $35, $38, but they get paid as low as $20, which is, you know, you could you just go out there and you could find a job, which is requires less, where you don't have to be bilingual, you don't have to know all this medical terminology. And so they're just feeling underpaid. Another big problem with this whole arrangement is that there's an information imbalance between the interpreters and these companies, where you're just like one person and you have all these companies, they're paying different amounts. And so you don't know what their costs are. You don't know what their expenses are. So it's kind of difficult to negotiate a higher rate. One of the interpreters I spoke with, he likened the coordinated care organizations to a black box, because they do the contracting with these companies. And you don't know what they're paying. You don't know. You know they get money. You know it flows through them, but you don't know what they're paying. And so, the union was saying that they got one of these contracts where the company was getting paid like $88 an hour for these contracts, but then the interpreter would get just like not even half of that.
Then you also talk a little bit about how people are depending on these jobs to survive. Can you tell me a little bit about how people are getting affected and not having health insurance and all this?
Yeah, I mean, the big one I heard from people was just health insurance, because as a contractor, you don't get health insurance through your job. And so that means you have to go buy it, you know, an individual policy. And anyone who's been paying attention to that knows that that has just gotten crazy expensive. And it's always been expensive. And I talked to one interpreter who is telling me that Carlos Burgos, he was saying that for his first 2 years being an interpreter, he did not have health insurance. Like, he's out there working in the medical field as a medical interpreter, but he's going without health insurance himself. And then you have to pay a big old tax bill, and it's always bigger than you think it's going to be. Retirement, you got to save for that. So it might be even $20. Like, you could go get a $20 job, an hour job from somewhere, but that might even come with benefits. So what I'm hearing is that there's interpreters who are just really struggling, just because you don't, the pay is unpredictable, and or it's just inconsistent, and then you got to have all the expenses as a freelancer on top of it.
Right. So what is being done to address these issues?
So the state has been trying to professionalize medical interpreting for years, particularly with Medicaid, because it covers a third of the state and it does involve a lot of public dollars. So the state created this registry of people who have training for medical interpreting, and in Oregon, you're supposed to use people from this registry if a medical appointment is going to be covered by Medicaid. But there's just loopholes in this law where, you know, the companies can find ways around it. And if they just really need to have somebody and they can't find somebody else, or if they find somebody who's otherwise qualified. So there's loopholes. So you have all these people who do this training, but then they don't, but then they're still competing with people who haven't. And so one of the big pushes recently to further professionalize this profession and try to make it easier for interpreters was this bill that was passed in 2024. And one of the big parts of the bill was it creates this online portal where if you're a trained medical interpreter, you can go on this portal and you can find appointments and you can sign up for them. And that way you can get paid more directly. Like, you can go to the work more directly without having to go through all these intermediaries. This setting up this online portal has proven to be really complicated, because it is Medicaid, which is just unbelievably complicated in itself. So the health authority is still setting up the portal. It's supposed to be up, you know, in a couple of years, but there's just a question of like just how much it's going to cost, and it's not up. So um, So in Washington State, they have they're also have unionized interpreters up there. And they have the portal is working, and the union has a negotiated contract where they get paid $50 an hour. It's a little bit less if it's like a minimum, if it's a virtual appointment or on the phone. But they've already set that up, and that's what they're trying to get here in Oregon, but it's going to be a while till they have it.
How can folks read this article?
So the best way is to go find your closest vendor. And if you don't know where your vendor is, you just go to streetroots.org, and we have a map that shows all the locations where we have a vendor.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jake.
Of course. Happy to do it.
For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What's this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It feels very